Good citizen Radio Bleeps. Train by day, Radio Bleeps by night. All day, all night.
Everybody wants information, but it comes so cheaply. Everybody wants a new reaction, but they're all still sleeping.
Welcome to episode number 2 of Good Citizen Radio Bleeps. In this episode, Professor Robeson and I discuss tech manifestos, billionaire delusions, the rise of therapeutic education, the limits of technocracy, how to keep a level head in our spiritual war, and we do our worst Klaus Schwab impressions. If you're listening to this somewhere other than thegoodcitizen.live, get on over there and subscribe for future episodes. Special thanks to good citizens who support my work from the Flock Meadow, and to the Free Flock members who click that share button. I cannot grow without your help. And now I give you part 2 of my conversation with my red pill mentor, Professor Gary Robeson.
We're explaining the why and the philosophy behind how technology is sort of co-opting people rather than vice versa. Where does social physics and Pentland come into this?
Social physics is a term invented by Auguste Comte, the founder of colleague of Saint-Simon, who I mentioned right. earlier. Like Saint-Simon, that such a thing as social physics would be possible, that right. rationally planned and we've talked about that already. Now, Alex Pentland and his acolytes, who I understand are quite numerous and very influential, the owners and controllers of financialized global capital, of whom we have been speaking, are very interested in this work. Well, his position is this, in his book, Social Physics, he says, okay, let's cut to the chase. The individual, you know, autonomous, self-aware, rationally choosing individual is dead. That's all over. The kind of modern conception of the Western modern conception of the individual is already history. What we've got now are an informational and technological system producing limitless amounts of super big data all of the time, you know, upon the basis of which we can now start to super nudge them in certain directions and move them as collectives. He talks about the hive and the hive mind and humans as being quite much more similar to bees than we like to think. He's proposing a post-individual science of perception and behavioral management and modification, which is based on just sucking in all of this data, nudging them at the collective level in certain directions on the basis of bringing them into line with what he calls social universals. Now, I don't think he ever very clearly specifies what these universals are. We might imagine that in a moment of kind of red or white hot super woke madness, a universal value is going to be whatever whatever Larry Fink at BlackRock says it is.
Right, exactly. What his computer says.
What the algorithms? What the
exactly?
What does he do? They do. They run all of those, what they called Monte Carlo simulations all the time. Mm-hmm. Endless numbers, thousands of simulations every day on their what's that? The Aladdin platform and all of that.
Aladdin, yeah.
Incredible technology. Yeah. So they've got the world's biggest, one of the world's biggest systems of powerful computer systems working on this. So that's what Pentland is claiming. He's claiming that because we are now so linked into the system, so having our sense of reality shaped by what we see on our screens, and the screens, we have to always remember, are becoming increasingly good at doing that because they have more and more and better data about us to feed us our particular version of reality into us. Yeah. So it can present to every individual user in this personalized way messaging which is designed to reach them very successfully because it knows them. The system knows them.
It's like a Klaus
Schwab.
Knows
them deep down.
The system will know you better than you know yourself.
The system will know you.
Yes.
The system will eat you. You will eat the bugs. The system will eat you.
Actually, maybe it was Yuval Harari, his Unter mentioned.
Him. The less said about that guy, the better, I think. Although I do have quite a lot about him in the book. I got it out of my system.
Yeah.
But I'm just trying to finish this idea. This idea that Pentland is offering technocratic forms of population nudge-based management and a kind of populations on the basis of behavior modification and influencing.
That's but this what, isn't really that far out there, is it? Because what we saw during the hoax pandemic, which we might as well call it, we saw, especially in the UK, they used predictive programming and behavioral nudging to nudge the population in a direction that the government wanted them to go.
Yeah.
And wanted the popular opinion to be molded to.
A unit called the Behavioral Insights Team. They, right at the, quite early in the pandemic, for want of a better word, in the operation, I wrote a thing for a blog, which was published by the London School of Economics. I co-wrote one with a colleague, and I called it, we called it A Tale of Two Lockdowns, Illiberal Democracy in Poland, which argued that Poland did kind of what you would expect it to do as an authoritarian, increasingly authoritarian sort of illiberal system, and psychotechnocracy in the UK. And what I just started to suggest there was that it was clearly visible that the population through the media was being absolutely terrorized and emotionally manipulated through fear, through the application of a pretty sophisticated applied psychology.
It wasn't algorithmically sort of behind the scenes, wasn't there nudging going on that was algorithmic?
Yeah, well, there wasn't nudging going on. There's a whole British, element in the British Army called the 77th Brigade, which is all over social media, all over Twitter and the rest of them. That's a kind of intelligence brigade of the British Army, which has been doing that through the pandemic and since, whether it's with kind of bots and, you know what they do. So that's an intelligent, that's a state, a state-run intelligence operation running alongside
a private corporation.
Activities of the Behavioral Insights Team.
But you have a sort of merger, and you talk about this quite a bit in a few chapters, I think chapter 3 and chapter 4. We are seeing the merger of private corporations, private massive technology monopolies, and Western governments in managing the impressions and the ideas of Western citizens.
Or trying to.
For a government agenda, which is...
Or a government corporate agenda. If you just look at the facts, I think this is why we have to be paying a lot of attention to BlackRock and the others, but BlackRock especially. The dividing line now between the executive branch in the US government and BlackRock, where one ends and one, it's very fuzzy now. I mean, BlackRock is very deeply embedded in the executive. This is all provable. It's all verifiable. There have been many examples of there's a revolving door between BlackRock and the administration, and Trump or Biden, it makes no difference. In the book, I have quite a long section on BlackRock because, in doing the research, I realized just how far this merger is going. And has gone. So that I think it makes no sense at all now to talk about we are back with Uncle Klaus, what's it called? Stakeholder capitalism, isn't it? Isn't it that kind of public-private stuff?
Partnerships.
BlackRock is halfway running. If you look at that very interesting moment in the early days of the pandemic when the Federal Reserve put BlackRock in charge of dealing with the financial management of the pandemic,
and all of
a sudden, more billionaires than ever before were created as they kind of between them funneled those trillions of dollars they created to their friends.
Right.
In one of the greatest economic scams in history.
Oh, man.
You can see it. You've got the government, you've got the Fed.
You look at the top 10 richest individuals in February of 2020, and then you look at them the following year, the summer of 2021, and their net worths had doubled, tripled, quadrupled.
Yes. And BlackRock did that. BlackRock and the Federal Reserve worked that together, didn't they?
They were running the Fed
this
window
is not
for
some,
them.
The Fed were their customers at that point, I think. They were working on behalf of them. So
is it too crazy to say that, because I have written about this in a number of pieces that good citizens might recognize, that democracy no longer exists in the West. It's merely a verbal tool for politicians to manipulate the population during election season or to give them the impression that there is a freedom of choice and that they're going to be a part of a participatory democracy and they're going to participate in the government and all this other bullshit. Are we not living in a fascist, semi-totalitarian era where corporations are controlling the government?
It looks pretty much like a more technologized version of the old corporate state of the 20th, of fascism, doesn't it? It's really starts to look like a corporate state, which is fascistic. Although it also seems to have quite communistic ideas about what the future might look like, with a tiny elite having the stuff and the rest of us eating the bugs.
Right. Speaking of tiny elite, I want to bring your attention to a piece that was written by Mark Andreessen. He's a Silicon Valley venture capitalist. I don't know if you've heard of him, of Andreessen Horowitz.
I've heard of him, but I don't know the company.
Yeah, he just wrote a manifesto, published a manifesto earlier this week called the Techno-Optimist Manifesto. I don't know if you haven't read it, have you?
No, but I will now. But what does it say?
So there's a lot of things that are easily agreeable, but he starts from a premise. I believe he starts from a premise of denying the past and sort of washing over the past, because it's a past that has made him a billionaire, has made him tremendously wealthy off companies like Facebook. So, you know, I don't think the whole thing is about technological determinism and technological solutionism. The overriding theme is that technological solutionism will win the day, and you're either a technological optimist and you believe that technological solutions will win the day and will solve, you know, humanity's problems, or they won't. And then he uses the term communist and Luddite in the same sentence, and they're only two words apart, communist and Luddite. But he starts from the premise of, we had a problem of darkness, so we invented electric lighting. Okay. We had a problem of cold, so we invented indoor heating. We had a problem of heat, so we invented air conditioning. We had a problem of isolation, so we invented the internet.
Oh, super.
Yeah.
Connectivity.
Yes. And, you know, maybe there's some truth to that with the early internet in the 90s, when it first came out. But the entire internet was a military invention anyway, and military... It emerged from military technology, from surveillance.
ARPANET, wasn't it?
Yeah, which you address in your book as well. And then his next sentence, I almost stopped reading after this. We had a problem of pandemic, so we invented vaccines. Give us real world problems and we can invent technologies to solve it, he says. I'm going to leave it at that. Maybe if you're interested, maybe you can read it and we can do a separate 30-minute talk about that and kind of dig into that.
You could do that, yeah.
20 or 30 minutes.
From what you're saying, this... advanced techno-solutionism. It sounds as dreamy.
Yeah.
It sounds as dreamy and pitched at the level of the 12-year-old. I have no problem with 12-year-olds. I mean, there are 12-year-olds that I love deeply. But, you know, it's this – it sounds like a fairy tale.
Right. And that's kind of, I think, the illusion. It's on Patrick Wood's website, technocracy.news. He says, proof that technocrats live in a simulacrum.
Yeah, they live in a world of their own, or at least...
Yeah, they live in a kind of parallel universe, don't they?
Yeah, they live in the same parallel universe where the content of Agenda 21/30 is meaningful and real.
I should say, a credit to Andreessen is that he actually calls out the World Economic Forum and ESG. He makes allusions to sort of libertarian economics or Austrian economic theory, Milton Friedman, the free market, you know, free market capitalism. So it's kind of a mixed manifesto, because there's quite a bit I agree with. There's a lot of it that's really obvious that anyone with common sense would agree with. A lot of sort of I don't know what you call those. We believe in bravery, in courage. We believe in pride, confidence, self-respect when earned. I don't know. It's things that, you know, very few people would disagree with.
Yeah. But then if you go back to Agenda 21, it's based on things that, who doesn't want the world to be a beautiful place? Who doesn't want poverty to end? Who doesn't want, it's all pitched at this level, isn't it? Of kind of wishful thinking on the basis of things that you've got to be an absolute monster to oppose.
Right. Yeah. Let me just read one more paragraph here. He has a section called The Enemy. We have enemies. Our enemies are not bad people, but rather bad ideas. Our present society has been subjected to a mass demoralization campaign for 6 decades against technology and against life, under varying names like existential risk, sustainability, ESG, SDG, social responsibility, stakeholder capitalism, trust and safety, tech ethics. So he's calling out the World Economic Forum.
Well,
this is
a more interesting piece than I thought. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, it is. It's not something I would throw out entirely, because there's a lot that I say, oh, yeah, great. He starts from a premise of where, you know, the internet solved isolation.
You've only got to spend 5 minutes with one of those gene twanging, narcissism epidemic or immiseration of the Western teenager and child and the kind of psychological destabilization, depression, to see that the notion that the internet is the solution to loneliness and all of that is patently absurd. The biggest problem for me, the single biggest problem in the work I was doing for some years before the COVID thing, is the disembodiment of people, especially the disembodiment of young children, and the replacement of embodied, you know, phenomenological, real world embodied experience with this ersatz screen based version has been an absolute catastrophe, I believe. And I think this is at the root of many, many of our problems now. The disembodiment of people at tender ages. Embodiment is a thing. Disembodiment is a thing, and it needs to be understood much better. I think if you experience of reality that the internet brings to us, especially to kids,
because it's experienced in a way it's not synchronous. It's dislocated in time and place,
and it's not real. It's not real. In my book and the stuff I did before the book, I spend quite a lot of time on the whole the neuroscience of the social brain, what a face-to-face communication does for a person, what the necessity of face-to-face communication from babyhood on in your body with real people in close proximity, looking into one another's eyes, is the most fundamental need of a child and a growing person, and actually of all of us, really. And they've pulled off this fantastic trick where they've convinced so many people that this so-called connectivity is somehow equivalent to connection. And I just don't think it is, and I don't think it ever can be. The research on, you know, mirror neurons and all of that is quite controversial, but it's very interesting. I mean, there is no replacement for you being in your body with another person, looking them in the face, and nothing you can ever do on the internet can reproduce that. That such a contention as we're sort of talking about is based on completely false idea of what human beings are. I mean, we're being dominated now by people, or people are seeking to dominate us, who barely even understand what a human being is or might be.
Right.
I'm talking about these extremely powerful people now.
This is the overall tone I got from Andreessen's manifesto, is that he doesn't put humans first. He puts technology first because he has benefited tremendously from technology.
Yes.
From technologies that haven't improved humanities. They have improved our processes of doing things as tools. They have improved our lives in many ways that they're innumerable, we can count. But in terms of the platforms that he funded, Facebook, Google, you know, I don't know if he funded Google, but I think he funded Facebook. He became a billionaire off of platforms that made us worse off than we were before the digital era.
I've immersed a couple of generations of children now at the beginning of their lives.
And he doesn't address that until the last 20 years of technological decay, is what I would call it, is addressed by someone like him. I cannot take him seriously.
Yeah, well, they're not going to address that for as long as they are entirely dependent upon the technology and its continuing development to...
Right. Last two chapters of your book, you write about the classroom laboratory, and you bring up something called social-emotional learning. What is social-emotional learning, and how has that changed education, and what is the sort of agenda behind that?
Well, this is a very interesting question. In fact, I've got two chapters in the book. I go into the question of utopian education or education designed to encourage utopian thinking in teachers and their pupils, and the emergence of therapy culture, so-called therapy culture, and therapy culture primarily, first of all, in education in the 1980s in the United States. It's this guy John Vasconcelos and the California Task Force on Self-Esteem and all of that. It's an interesting story, but the point of that is that there's a shift in educational ethos which is designed to use education as an instrument of social policy based on the application of psychology, a therapeutic psychology in the classroom. So that's really just the context for the second part, the second chapter on this. So I argue fairly well-established argument that there was a switch to a much more therapeutic ethos in education, which many critics and I conclude was largely to the detriment of the child, because it forces them. Which is not to say that there are children in schools who require therapy, and a child that requires help and assistance, of course, should get it. The problem is treating all of the kids in a given class as if they all potentially need sustained therapeutic help. So there's that whole argument, which then has an effect on the formation of kind of children in schools, arguably enfeebling approach.
That's a good word.
To children, which can be construed as a kind of an attack on their resilience. Talked about, in the kind of older world of the shit happens and you go through it. And you go through the ordeals and you meet the challenges. I know all the arguments on both sides of that are with bullying and so on. But still, there is a shift to the management of young people in therapeutic terms, away from an older model of education. So what's happened more? So that's a thing. That's really been a thing now around the question of building children's self-esteem, rather than in the old days before self-esteem was something everybody talked about, expecting to acquire or develop self-esteem through effort, and struggle. So there's that argument about the therapeutic education, handling of children. And then in the second one, which is where we get to social emotional learning, there is the fairly recent reiteration of that older project in a way that is very highly politicized in like Marxist Maoist terms. So about 3 years ago, the main kind of organization or group that sort of has been responsible for the development of therapeutic learning, which was called social emotional learning for some years, but was really just like the therapeutic idea of education or therapy in the classroom. It changed around about 3 years ago. This group was called CASEL. I can't remember what the acronym stands for, but it's the group that has kind of made the running on the social emotional learning front. About 3 years ago, it changed. And I demonstrate the change in the book, and it stopped being about, it gets very radically politicized, coming from this organization, CASEL, C-A-S-E-L. And before you know where you are, all this language of intersectionality, all of the stuff that anybody who is exposed to the woke language and ideology is familiar with, has been layered on top of this therapeutic approach to children in a deliberate attempt to encourage children through their education to become politically active.
It stands for, real quickly, it stands for Collaborative for Academic, Social, and Emotional Learning.
Yeah, CASEL. Right. So now, if you look, there's some pretty good evidence that if you remember all of those controversy, critical race theory, all that stuff, all that cultural Marxist stuff, It layered all of that in with the therapy stuff. So now you get, and this is the argument, Christopher Caldwell's book is very good on this, what's it called? The Age of Entitlement. He actually shows that now America is laboring under, there are two constitutions and two groups of people, which is the basis of the polarization. There are people who adhere to and want to live by the principles of the Constitution. And then there are people who want to live by the principles of the new post-1960s replacement constitution, which is all based on all the stuff that's been sedimented in law in terms of diversity and civil rights since the 1960s. And that process, he argues, and it seems convincing to me, that process of getting quite radical political positions sedimented into the institutions, into the legal system and the institutions, was a political project run by radicals, starting with, let's say, Herbert Marcuse in that kind of 60s iteration of cultural Marxism. In order for this to make sense, you would have to follow that line of reasoning, which has been a serious politicization of education in the direction of activism and the coming together of a therapeutic approach to children, which is all about their emotions, with an ideology and a set of propositions which are extremely kind of left radical and revolutionary, which is woke. And this goes across the race, gender, sexuality, and environment domains.
Right.
Primarily. Which would tend, where it's successful, to push them towards the position of kind of activist radicalism and a disavowal again, just like the Cultural Revolution in China and the Red Guard, a disavowal of everything that happened before, of their parents and their grandparents' culture, values, and all the rest of it. So there is the radical politicization of education by activist teachers and educators, the channeling, the attempt to channel children into this activist mindset, activist revolutionary, a kind of rejecting of the past mindset, in which sustainable development, come on, kids, we've got to save the planet. All these things go together. We've got to save the planet. We've got to achieve racial justice. We've got to end transphobia. We've got to do all of these things because they're all connected. They're all aspects of the same lack of justice and righteousness in the world. So that new iteration of social emotional education is what is being kind of operationalized now, I think, at school and university level now for some years. And it's linked in a very interesting way that really needs to be understood better with the stuff we talked about earlier, the top-down, big money, BlackRock ESG, corporate fascist state stuff, which is actually driving and pushing this stuff itself. And if you look at the ESG, the social, environmental, social, what's it called? Environmental and social governance framework, which was actually, like so many other things, pushed through the United Nations by corporate interests about 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. The corporations, and Larry Fink, the CEO of BlackRock, is the face of this, are enforcing the principles of the diversity and inclusion and equity index, or whatever it is, DEI. This is now being enforced from the top down across institutions, businesses, corporations, and just about everything else. Yeah. So they've got corporations and businesses competing with one another to show who can be the most woke.
Right.
Because that brings you financial and growth benefits for your operation budgeting for your kind of state institution. So the question now to answer is how all this fits together and what's behind it.
Right.
I have some ideas which I can share with you if you would just like me to briefly.
Yes, please. That's why you're here. Well,
what is it? I mean, what is this? So why is the big money power enforcing in social and commercial institutions and practices a Maoist political ideology? What the hell is that about? The only conclusion I can really draw is that the owners and controllers of financialized global capital have in mind a technocratic fourth industrial revolution type society in the West, in which, like older versions of outright communism, a tiny elite controls power, resources, and everybody else does what they can to survive and avoid punishment. What is this thing we're calling woke? What is it really? So it seems to me, and my argument in the book is that it's actually a very deep thing. You can trivialize it. You can say, look at all these crazies. But it's actually a very serious thing because it's like a metaphysic or a religion or an ersatz religion without a deity.
A cult.
Because it's a cult. In numbers, it covers a lot of bases. There's a crisis of meaning, isn't there, in the Western societies, we understand. Right. People need to identify and attach themselves to something which is spiritualized or at least has some kind of ethics in it. I see woke as a skeletal, as an absolutely skeletal ethical system designed to replace things like religious or spiritual. I see it as an attempt to build a system of thought control, but also a kind of very skeletal form of ethics, which is there to do two things: justify and validate this power grab, which is occurring, this coup, validate it. Because this is why all we ever hear about is sustainability, diversity, inclusion. Sustainability, diversity, I think it's the two things. I think it's a very primitive but actually potentially successful in the context of the knowledge gap that we talked about earlier, where people don't know that much, attempt to provide what seems to be a satisfactory justification for the activities of this so-called elite network of actors, plus something that a lot of people can get behind as a pseudo-religion. bearing in mind what Solzhenitsyn said, you know, about if you, it's one thing to be brainwashed. It's another thing to go along with things that you know are not true.
Are not true, yeah.
And not real and can't be true. Then you are being humiliated and controlled simultaneously. I think it's Solzhenitsyn has that somewhere. They're controlling and humiliating you in the kind of, and then you come to Maoism and all the, look around now, look at all the humiliation rituals you see in American public life. Yeah. Somebody says the wrong thing. Somebody may have done the wrong thing. Now there's going to be a Mao-style struggle session or self-criticism. So I think I'm trying to get just to the point. I think that's the point. I think all of this woke stuff is an attempt to put a kind of a meaningful smokescreen across the real activities of the owners and controllers of financialized global capital and give their victims, which is to say humanity at large, a kind of uniform sort of mindset which supports the situation.
And you also bring
that's
in,
why I think, yeah.
which is key, I think, which reinforces your previous chapters, is you bring in the child machine interface and the sort of data mind pupil that we can educate these kids based on their using technology to reinforce this ethics, the skeletal ethics. We can reinforce all that through algorithmic manipulation, algorithmic repetition, through massaging those neurotransmitters and getting them to release that dopamine on schedule so that it reinforces this belief and it fully assimilates them to this Borg, to this hive mind.
This is the most terrifying thing. Anybody interested in this should read John Klycek's book, School World Order. And I took a lot from that for that chapter. I met John recently at a conference we had in Krakow. It was really great to meet him. I invited him to the conference because I think this is such an important thing. He's writing about the kind of new generation of educational technology, you know, from headsets to skin transduction, like devices that measure the engagement of kids in the classroom and all of these things and various monitors on the body and other, you know, cameras in the room, fisheye cameras, all these kind of things. Every child now in the United States is being continually data mined. It's the creepiest thing ever.
Yeah.
Every child, I argue in the book that the American school child or pupil is now probably the most data mined person in the world. And each kid is having a very fine grained social, emotional profile as well and cognitive. A profile developed of them. That data, that individual data on every kid is going into a system which is going to feed back to them via the kind of so-called personalized learning pathways that parents loved it, the sound of. You know? Or schools love the sound. Educational institutions love the sound of it.
But this information is being absorbed by the state too, right?
Yeah, it's going everywhere. It's being absorbed by the state. It's being absorbed by corporations. It's being absorbed. It's there in the pot. But I think what it's going to mean, and this is what John writes about in his book, is that with the new increasingly sophisticated educational technologies, which lock children into these cybernetic loops on the basis of algorithms absolutely saturated with very intimate information about how they are, who they are and how they respond to things, without them knowing, without their parents knowing.
Without their parents knowing,
It's like Skinner. It's like a B.F. Skinner and behaviorism on rocket fuel. The good citizens of the future.
Yeah. When you really project into the future, not in the distant future, but in just the immediate future and imagine the possibilities of what you can do with this amount of information on children and an entire generation, it's pretty scary to think how you can further manipulate them and then sort of cross-connect these platforms from not just their education and the technology that's used to educate them, but sort of transfer that into the future when they start joining these social platforms, aka social platforms, and that information can be input into their profile to tune to, you know, to customize the algorithm for them based on their entire education, based on all the information and all their behavior and even biometrics and other information, intimate information that is beyond Orwellian that can be used to manipulate them in the future in ways that they didn't know is happening, that they're not going to know is happening. I mean, it's beyond science fiction.
Exactly. I think it's more like Brave New World than Orwell. I think it's more Huxley than Orwellian because I was thinking about this recently. If you've been watching this WorldCoin stuff, this kind of theatrics where the kids are queuing up to have their eyeball scan done by the orb, that stuff for WorldCoin.
Yeah, Yeah, but I've seen that.
What you got there, and that reminds me of where in Brave New World, Huxley writes words to the effect of that the slave comes to embrace and enjoy their own servitude.
Mm.
So when I see these, I don't know how much of that is staged for marketing purposes, but they look like long queues of people queuing up to have their eyes scanned.
And I believe people are actually lining up for that shit. I believe it.
Yeah, I believe they are. And yeah. I think that what we're talking about is a very core part of the process of producing, let's say, the young adult who is absolutely fine with the reality that they find them, or the pseudo reality that they find themselves in as a young adult, and will not push back against it, will not feel any particular need to protest because they are, well, being dopamine. I don't know. Does that burn out at some point? The dopamine, does the rewards, does it run out of dopamine? I don't know. I think I have a feeling it does. But, you know, I'm just trying to, at the moment, during the pandemic, things are happening and people are pushing back. Not enough, but some.
Yeah.
But the ideal technocratic solution to all of this is to get to the point where you can pursue your operations without meeting very much resistance, because everybody's more or less on board through these processes we were just discussing a couple of minutes ago in the formation of children.
Right.
I don't know. I'm just speculating. It's like a bad dystopia now, but I don't know if they get away with this, if it all ends up well. There's a lot of moving parts in all this. I don't know where it's all going, but that looks to me like a core component of the plan where the kids are concerned.
Yes, definitely. I don't think, I think it's a kind of reinforcing loop, the dopamine rewards. People keep going back to it. In studies on addictive gambling, which is where all this came from, as you mentioned earlier, with the slot machines in Vegas, they don't stop. They just keep going back and they keep going back, and they start questioning their behavior at a certain point. Why am I pulling this lever? Why do I keep putting money in this machine? Why do I keep losing money? Why do I keep pulling this lever? And it's at a certain point, they realize it's not about winning money. It's about the feeling that it gives them of just repeating the same behavior over and over again.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think those in power that are, you know, this global technocratic order, they know that. They know that for sure. And they're using particularly the smartphone as either a jumping off point, a transition technology to something more invasive, more ingrained in the body.
Yeah.
And maybe that technology that's more ingrained in the body already exists and already exists within the body of humans. Wink, wink. And, you know, maybe this is already happening much further along than we could possibly know.
Yeah. Yeah. It wouldn't be a surprise if that turns out. Yeah. Yeah.
Your final chapter was one of my favorite because you sort of frame this as a, not a good versus evil, but a technocracy unchained or technocracy unleashed versus the soul of humanity, the soul of what it means to be human. Your concluding narrative is optimistic. So you end on a pretty optimistic tone, drawing parallels between the transformation from eugenics to transhumanism, which is what we were just about to get into, but stopped short of, to, you know, what does it mean to be human? What does it mean to have a consciousness? How important is that? And how do we as individuals and as a society maintain our humanity through all this madness?
Yeah, I'm not pessimistic. I don't know. It's clearly a spiritual battle. And it could be at a number of levels. I sometimes have the feeling that in some, you know, we're at some point in a cycle, in a kind of cosmic or universal or earth cycle, which we don't understand very well, in which everything has to change around about now anyway, and these people think they can control it. Sometimes I think that's the case. That's, you know, more esoteric than I'm very well equipped to talk about. Even at the base level of the kind of material reality of what's happening, we can perceive, I think, very clearly that the actors we're talking about have deeply, deeply anti-human, completely materialist, and completely, but while at the same time being completely spiritless and anti-human perspective on us as beings. This then becomes a question of an exercise of profound evil against humanity, which is either not even understood by those actors and their managers and useful idiots, not even understood, which is a strange kind of situation. And then as a baseline, that makes it a spiritual struggle because we are resisting evil or trying to resist evil. Beyond that, there's the whole question of the extent to which all this, you know, esoteric stuff or swirls around these so-called elite, some of these so-called elite groups. That I leave for other people to deal with. That's not really my wheelhouse. I mean, I'm a Christian. I feel that we're in the middle of a struggle in which some force is trying to supplant God as the supreme power in this world. And since it's a spiritual struggle, I think it's very hard to predict where the outcome. Although I'm pretty confident that the outcome will likely ultimately be in the favor of humanity. And because there's just something about this, there are so many moving parts in what's being attempted to get this, let's say, a technocracy properly, a kind of anti or transhuman technocracy installed. About 2 years ago, I was quite depressed and pessimistic. I think like a lot of us.
Who I remember getting your emails really when you finished the book. Yeah, you seemed a bit drained.
But I'm not as drained as I was. I just think it's in the balance. And the more of us that don't submit to despondency, but try to together kind of hold and maintain a space for humanity, you know, going forward, a space that we can, you know, live and flourish in, the better. And it seems that our number is being added to every day. These actors are, whatever they think and whatever heights of narcissism and power mania they are subject to, are not the equal of God's or our God. I don't say we haven't got a hard road ahead, because we clearly got a hard road ahead for at least some time. But I don't
really,
I don't know.
Is at the core of this theme is that man playing God over other men. This kind of repetitive theme of technocracy throughout the ages, is it not?
But isn't it interesting? Because I've just, you know, when I wrote the book, I was still using the phrase elites. And that's why I've switched. I'm not doing that anymore. I've switched to owners and controllers of financialized, because it's hard work to say, but it's okay when you're writing it down. There is nothing elite about these players. Many of them are of such low-grade human material.
That's what my wise readers keep reminding me of, is there's nothing elite about them.
Such low-grade human material that to call them elite anything is absurd. I think in the last couple of years, they've done a very good job of getting inside everybody's head and making them seem super powerful and imposing. I'm not buying that anymore. So I think we just need to shift the focus a little bit on this and
find some perspective.
Not just submit to it and not give way to pessimism, because then they've got you. If you give up and become completely despondent, and they've opened a channel into you, and they've conquered you.
Yeah, that's a great point. I've made that point a few times in some writings. Is that if you let that which is without, you know, beyond your control, control you, control your mind, control your state of being, control your well-being, and especially control your physical well-being, well, man, you're really losing at this game. You need to be above and beyond these people, because you're never going to meet them, you're never going to see them, you're never going to touch them. And in the end, do they really have that much power over you as an individual in the choices that you make in your everyday life that concern you and that concern your future? I think most people would answer no. They don't, you know.
No, but I think it's easy to overestimate the extent to which they do, but they don't, because as of now, it's mostly just psychological warfare, isn't it? Apart from the poor people who've been damaged by the injections, or killed or damaged by the injections, which is a very substantial and significant thing. I shouldn't have said that. But having said that, and without belittling that, the kind of great human outrage and kind of tragedy that represents, much of it has been psychological warfare, which is quite resistible. I think sort of manageable if you get yourself into the right place spiritually and arm yourself with information. I just think we need to talk to each other, you know, and be in our bodies as much as possible with others. And when it comes to children and young people, just do everything we can to get them back into their bodies together, doing various things. I've got a short solutions section in the book at the end. Yes. Which is about just to remind people that there are many tried and tested ways of making it, you know, helping young people establish mm-hmm. themselves, you know, as healthy, autonomous, but also very social characters in the world. And that we don't have to invent anything new. We just have to get them out of the matrix if we can.
Yes.
And get them into their bodies together, doing meaningful and enjoyable things. And I think that's where solutions are. Solutions are in real life with people working together and just trying to pull away from just living in these screens all the time.
Yeah, because that's where they can control you. This might be a great time for a story, if you don't mind me interjecting a story.
Not at all.
I think it was about 8 years ago that you were on a family walk. You told me that you, on Sunday afternoons, would take family walks along the river, and you were with your middle daughter, Senya, and she was on her phone. You had told her to leave it at home for the family walk, and she was on her phone throughout the whole walk, about 10 or 15 paces behind you. And at some point, you got so fed up that you grabbed her phone and you threw it in the creek or the river or something. I can't remember the details. Well,
I smashed it into pieces first. I'm not proud of this. I don't know why you're kind of undermining my credibility. I smashed it to pieces with the heel of my boot, dashed it away where it belonged. And
I thought you threw it in the creek.
She did. I kicked it. I kicked it there. And then she, strangely enough, she didn't even seem to bother that much. I think she was almost relieved.
Okay.
She kicked off. She went through a certain amount of protest.
Yeah.
But she wasn't as. I don't know. I just needed to make the point. This was a long time ago.
This was over a decade ago, maybe. Yeah.
This was a long time ago. This was because I was just starting to intuit or feel how dangerous these devices are.
Yeah. Know? Well, I had just met you like a year earlier. Yeah. And this is how you and I kind of came together, was on all this.
That's right.
Digital natives, and because I was born like you, pre-digital era. I had lived half my life in the pre-digital era, I call it the analog era or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so I could tell the difference that, you know, between that first half of my life and the second half of my life. And that's how you and I kind of found common ground when I first met you.
Yeah, because not a lot of people could see it. Yeah,
no,
because you were one of the because I don't know, from the moment I first saw a smartphone in the hand of a child. I just knew bad things were coming. And everybody I said that to just thought I was a crazy person, but you were one of the only people who took me seriously.
I saw hell too. I saw all kinds of hell coming from, I didn't mean to undermine you with that story, but I thought it was.
I was joking.
Oh, okay.
I'm just trying to be a kind of a guy who writes books, not the guy who smashes up his kids' phones into a thousand small fragments. Although I have both.
I think that
was both people.
You know, as a father, I think that what a great thing you could do for your daughter, really.
I don't know what the long term effect, because I plugged away after that, and now she's 23 now, and she's she doesn't live inside the phone. She uses the phone. She doesn't have social. She got rid of all her social media some time back.
Yeah,
she uses the phone to take photos, I think, and.
Talk to her friends
and keep in contact and listen to, she's really into, listen to music, but I think that's it. So,
maybe we just, our concerns were overblown and, things turn out in the end better than we imagined them maybe that's the case. Cause there are millennials who started out, like Senya with a phone in their hand at a very young age. And I think, with age comes wisdom, and with wisdom comes the ability for self-control and to adapt and to not repeat old behavior and to modify behavior and so forth.
Yeah, this is why I try not to be. I think there are very concerning things happening, mm-hmm. but I think what you've just said is very, very important. And it's easy to get sucked into just thinking, it's all headed for an unavoidable catastrophe. But no, things happen. So that particular 23-year-old who was once utterly addicted to her phone is kind of got a balanced relationship with it now, and I think it's not controlling her from what I can see.
Yeah, that's great.
So, yeah.
Well, this has been a great talk, and I appreciate you.
Yeah, I've enjoyed it. Thank you.
Taking the time to chat. I'd like to bring you back on to talk about music and music culture. You and I have talked about the spigot through many a nights watching YouTube music videos, and how, well, I'll abbreviate and just say that, at a certain point, music just started sucking. And you have a pretty good theory about why that is. And as a professor of cultural studies and sociology and someone who teaches music culture, I'd like to pick your brain about that on a future Radio Bleat, if that's okay with you.
Sounds great. Yep. I think that's an excellent idea. Yeah.
Okay. We'll do another episode on the spigot in the future. And until then, take care. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me. I've enjoyed it. Cheers.
Cheers.